Hi, stranger. What are you wearing right now? I don't mean to flirt. Literally, what are you wearing? Where do the clothes you wear come from? How are they made? Unless you work in the fashion industry or picked up sewing as a hobby, you may not be aware of just how much goes into and results from the clothes we wear every day. Just as many of us have become divorced from the cycles and processes that feed us daily, many of us are totally disconnected from the material reality of how our clothes are made. When considering just how widespread the practices of both agriculture and garment making were throughout human history, this is a pretty unusual state of affairs to find ourselves in. There was once a time when you could travel from region to region and find a dazzling diversity of dress. Some folks would be wearing everything silk, others were dripped out in salmon skin, you had people wearing animal hides and wools, but others adorned themselves in linens and cottons. Not to mention the variety of colors drawn from crushed beetles, bark, berries, and other biological byproducts. For most of history, everyone was repping their set, reflecting the climate and ecology of their local environment with the materials they used, and signaling their cultural, gender, and class identity with specialty patterns, weaves, knits, symbols, and flourishes. Each fit was a story. Nowadays, thanks mostly to colonialism, the Industrial Revolution, and globalization, everyone wears pretty much the same thing, with few exceptions. We have a global uniform. T-shirts, jeans, dress shirts, suits, dresses, and skirts. Almost always made from either or both cotton and plastic. This is obviously oversimplifying the diversity still present in how people choose to present themselves. I'm not denying the various fashion subcultures, nor the mind-blowing magic that is Wisdom K. I mean, come on, look at him. And while I'm at it, shout out to Frugal Aesthetic. But in going from a time when each and every place had its own flavor of fashion, and textile production was the most popular art, to a time when clothing is controlled by capitalists, something was definitely lost. In going from a time when we spent as much time in our communities clothing ourselves as we did feeding ourselves, to a time when both agriculture and fashion are managed by megacorporations that exploit both people and planet, I think we got into some problems. Let me spin you a tale about our clothing. By the end, if we can understand how our clothes are interwoven with identity, class, and self-expression, and confront the stained reality of the fashion industry today, perhaps we'll be able to stitch together a future for fashion that mends our connection with self-expression, ecology, and community. Stay tuned. This isn't your typical fast fashion bad video. We don't know exactly when or why we stopped letting everything hang out, but we started playing dress up at some point between 83,000 to 170,000 years ago. That's around when body lice and head lice diverged from a common ancestor, and we invented sewing needles between 25,000 and 40,000 years ago. We started walking around 4 million years ago, talking around... I'm getting weird that we haven't figured that out yet. Apparently, language doesn't fossilize. But we know we got writing around 5,600 years ago. So we don't know when we had the words for it, but we do have a rough idea of when we started letting our style speak for itself. Once we started getting dressed, let's just say that other species couldn't compete with our drip. We even started wearing some of them like trophies. We also domesticated sheep for their wool and domesticated flax to make linen. The oldest fabric in the archaeological record, dated to around 36,000 years ago, was made from linen, found in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains. After a few millennia of getting dressed, clothing became an arena for social conflict. Through clothing, various societies have answered questions like how much inequality should exist between people and should they be able to rise in the world? How does a society treat its children and adults, mortals and gods, women and men? The story of clothing is intertwined with women's history. The creation and maintenance of clothing may not have been an exclusively women's affair, just like hunting may not have been an exclusively men's affair, but in both cases, in most cultures, it took on a gendered dimension over time. Across societies, deities associated with spinning and weaving were women, whether you're talking about Athena and the three fates of Greek mythology, Neith of Egyptian mythology, or the spider grandmother of Hopi and Navajo mythology. Beyond clothing, textile production was a way for the illiterate to pass along stories through tapestries. It was a way for women to make their presence known in the historical record. The famous Bayeux tapestry, for instance, was most likely woven by women. Unfortunately, the respect given to this labor has fluctuated with time, sometimes being highly regarded, and other times being dismissed as frivolous women's work. Clothing has also been a means of signalling women's position in society. If you've ever wondered why men's clothing is typically so boring compared to women's, part of the explanation comes from a paradigm shift that the British psychoanalyst John Flugel dubbed the Great Renunciation, which took place in the last quarter of the 18th century. Once upon a time in Western European history, men actually wore bright colours and had elaborate shapes and variety in their dress. But as centres of power shifted from the royal court of the aristocracy to the professional office of the capitalist, and as women's autonomy in society was eroded by new laws, evolving social norms, and industrialization, the ideal of men's clothing came to emphasize their role as active subjects, while the ideal of women's clothing defined them as passive yet ornate objects. As Flugel asserts, man abandoned his claim to be considered beautiful. He henceforth aimed at being only useful. Men left their silks, high heels, and makeup to the ladies, and instead draped themselves in the often somber colours of the traditional suit, which would gain global adoption over the course of the 20th century. As we zigzag our way through my heavily abridged history of clothing, we find that it wears quite a few hats. Including its climatic necessity in the heat and the cold, American author Sophie Thanhouser notes in One, A People's History of Clothing, that they are scarcely a part of the human experience, historic or current, that the story of clothes does not touch. Think about it. People bridged east and west for the sake of silk, colonized Canada for furs, and abducted Africans by the millions to grow, among other things, cotton. And speaking of cotton, its presence on commercial plantations was and is a historical aberration. Cotton was raised around the world for thousands of years in polycultures, alongside rice, yam, corn, and more. It was also grown only a few kilometers from where it was processed, either at home or by a network of artisans. But everything changed when cotton became the key to the Industrial Revolution. It was torn from these sustainable systems and converted into a monoculture crop fueled by exploitation. The profiteers of this exploitation, from India to the US to Xinjiang, have done so with staggering indifference to human and ecological suffering. As the US expanded southward and westward, it did so in search of more fertile land to replace that which had been exhausted by monocropped cotton. When enslaved people were finally freed, the continued demand for cotton led to the development of sharecropping, where those same freed men and women were forced back onto plantations by a punishing system of perpetual debt. Nowadays, cotton accounts for up to 5% of global pesticide usage and contributes to water stress across Asia. The overall textile industry hasn't been doing too hot when it comes to the environment and labour either. Between 2000 and 2015, clothing production around the world doubled, and consumers bought 60% more clothes than before, but kept each garment for half as long. This is partially because petroleum-based fabrics, which are usually considered cheap and disposable, have replaced cotton as the most commonly worn fabric in the world. Hence why a garbage truck's worth of clothes was burned or sent to landfills for every second in 2017. The textile industry produces 20% of global wastewater and 10% of global carbon emissions, as although human hands haven't been replaced in every step of the process, much of the spinning and weaving of cloth is now powered by electricity derived from fossil fuels. But let's discuss those human hands, because sewing garments is a laborious step in the process that we can't replace with machines, at least for now. Since the dawn of industrialization, textile work has been deadly. Early textile mills were filled with the noise of machinery and the dangers of moving parts that often mutilated workers' hands and hair. Airborne cotton fibers filled workers' lungs, while cramped conditions made accidents inevitable. Today, the reality isn't much different for millions of garment workers around the world, over two-thirds of which are women, who still sew or clothes by hand in poorly ventilated, overcrowded factories while putting up with low wages and grueling hours. Some of the deadliest garment factory disasters in history have occurred in this century. Additionally, whether they're dealing with polyesters or dire natural fibers, workers and their surrounding environments often being exposed to toxic levels of carbon disulfide, chromium, lead, cadmium, sulfur, nitrates, chlorine compounds, arsenic, mercury, nickel, and cobalt. Thanks to the multinational nature of this industry, these workers are going to have a brutal fight ahead of them, organizing whole continents and facing off against exploiters living an ocean away if they want to see change. And speaking of the elites responsible for this exploitation, Throughout history, they have won whatever would differentiate themselves from people like you and me, and in some cases, enforced laws that would keep the poor looking poor. In France, for instance, 18 decrees were passed between 1485 and 1660 regarding clothing and ornamentation, including prohibiting all non-nobles from copying the style or dress of nobility. Even now, the oligarchic obsession with monopolizing opulence has not gone obsolete. It might not look like ruffs, doublets, and farthingales anymore, but rest assured that they'll still continue to uphold other in-group signifiers, like certain fabrics or cuts of cloth. Linen was once the commoner's cloth, but now the commoners are dressed in plastic, and the rich style in linen. If you know, you know. To understand fashion is to understand where you may be placed in a plenitude of hierarchies. Clothes are seen as a way to express one's personal style and individuality. But we also live in the era of ready-to-wear, mass-produced clothing. Many people now lack even the basic skills and education about clothing and textiles that were once commonplace. Until recently, garment making was a mostly local and home-based craft. The few who could afford to, in some parts of the world, went to a tailor or seamstress. It was the rise of the textile mill that enabled the first mass-produced, ready-to-wear garments, paired with the advent of standard sizing. Such innovations supercharged the mass potential of the fashion industry, but also subjected the majority of garment workers to the mind-numbing tedium of following the same pre-approved patterns day in and day out to feed the insatiable appetite of consumerism. Nowadays, being on the poorer side of the working class may not mean starving. It might mean being poisoned by junk food because it's all you can afford. The poor aren't necessarily dressed in peasant rags, you know. Instead, you might find them in fashionable plastic fibers. American historian Stuart Wynne once wrote that mass fashion provided a means by which poor people could develop an appearance of upward mobility. Where working people had once looked as poor as they were, now they were able to take on the appearance of abundance. Even as wealth inequality worsens, the abundance of cheap clothing enabled by mass production has ensured that nearly everybody is buying more clothing than ever before. It seems that there's something comforting about consumerism for a people clearly wanting for community, commons, and culture. Advertisers would redirect the frustrations people have with their monotonous, exhausted, and paltry material conditions with the superficial consumption of the new. As Stanhauser summarized, personal frustrations of all kinds could be redirected towards purchases, not politics. With ever-accelerating trend cycles and ever-accessible clothing, why not dress up nice and feel like you're rich? Even if the gap between rich and poor widens into a nigh insurmountable chasm. Instead of recognizing your potential collective power, accept your individual station in life and buy yourself a little treat. In fact, all of your problems could be solved with purchases. Need to exercise? Consume. Need a partner? Consume. Need a job? Consume. Work sucks? Well, forget the gratification that can come from meaningful work and tight-knit community. You're just a cog in the machine. So consume. Consume.
Consume.
Now, the advertisers are not going to show you the cost of this consumption. Ideally, the consumer should never see the factories in which these things are made, the environment surrounding those factories, or the conditions of the people who make them. Because that would make the advertiser's job a bit harder, you see. When you walk into a clothing store or scroll through an online store, they don't want you thinking about sweatshops, water stress, carcinogens, and soil depletion. That would be bad for business. When they do get caught, as they often have, their PR teams work overtime to ensure that the consumers are soothed back into consumption. Call it the performance of ethics. They speak of corporate responsibility and codes of conduct, but these codes don't make any real difference on the ground. Brands claim to work with contractors and subcontractors with the highest standards of safety, yet hundreds of workers are killed or injured by the negligence of their bosses in the garment factories these brands work with around the world. Remake's 2024 Fashion Accountability Report revealed the obvious. Major fashion brands' commitments to ethics and sustainability are nothing but empty promises. Out of the 150 possible points they could have scored, no company reviewed by Remake managed to exceed 40. Those are failing grades all around. The wages and working conditions still suck, they're still polluting the atmosphere, soil and water, companies market their sustainable capsule collections while the vast majority of their production volume is far from it, and the industry as a whole continues to overproduce and then fail to recycle the excess. On top of all that, The supply chains still lack transparency, so there's likely even more hidden environmental and human rights abuses yet to be uncovered. So what would an ethical fashion industry even look like? Well, under this capitalist system, it would mean that your clothes would cost more. You could buy a pair of jeans right now for $20 because the material sucks, the collective force of the workers is being heavily exploited by multinational corporations, and the planet we all share is paying the cost. But the clothes are cheap, so we're not really incentivized to care. A massive, yet ultimately band-aid solution would be cutting down on mass production to focus on craftsmanship, and enforcing stronger worker and environmental rights and protections worldwide. Then yeah, clothes would cost a lot more, and most people are going to have to be a bit more conscious about what they purchase. Clothing production might actually localize again to cut down on transportation costs. More people would look to secondhand solutions for their fashion fix. And folks might start to learn how to maintain and repair their clothes again out of necessity. Fashion would become even more of a luxury hobby than it is now. But if this is the first time you've come across my work, first of all, hi, please subscribe. Secondly, you should know that my focus is not on small tweaks and band-aid solutions to this existing state of affairs. My goal is not a world where people who can barely afford food and rent will now have to scrape together a few hundred or a few $1,000s for a pair of jeans, even if that does help to eliminate hyper-consumerism. I don't think the workers should have to suffer so their clothes stay cheap for consumers, but I also don't think the consumers, who are also mostly workers, should be struggling to dress themselves either. I'm not against worker and environmental protections as a partial solution to the issues plaguing the fashion industry, but I think we could do even better for everybody if we're willing to venture outside the box. What we need to truly transform the fashion industry goes well beyond it. The multi-trillion dollar fashion industry is just one of the many heads of this hydra we call capitalism, which is itself a mere grandchild of the great titan hierarchy. If you really think about it, the stratification of society, which gives some individuals, groups, and institutions the recognized right above others to give commands, make decisions, and enforce obedience, this affliction of authority, can be tied to many of our world's most pressing issues. These are fearsome beasts, but they are not all-powerful. They can be dismantled through the process of social revolution. Now, your mind might immediately go to some sort of cinematic episode of history, with guns blazing and masses rioting. But there's far more to revolution than what meets the eye. Social revolution, as anarchists like myself use the term, refers to an ongoing and intentional transformation of basically everything. Building a new society out of the shell of the old. This new society we're striving towards is one without rule nor dogmas of rule, where free association, self-determination, and mutuality form the basis of our society. Creating this change requires a careful analysis of our current conditions that would inform the use of the means of change that are compatible with our desired ends. In many instances, creating this change means we'll have to go against the grain or counterculture. But not to worry, dyed mohawks and spiky jeans are not a requirement. So how do you create social revolutionary change? And how can those acts affect the future of fashion? Great questions. The simplest breakdown, though really all of these ideas overlap, is that we need acts of confrontation and non-cooperation, or the things you do to oppose the current system, and acts of promotion and prefiguration, the things you do to propose alternative ways of thinking and doing things. Confrontation looks like protests to both raise awareness and directly challenge authorities, sabotage and obstruction like blockades or occupations to prevent harm, expropriation to redistribute resources, and when the situation calls for it, defense. There may be fashion brands or factories near you that are currently causing serious harm to workers and to the environment, and you can evaluate what you and others are capable of doing to confront them. Or there may be abandoned retail spaces and manufacturing sites that could be reclaimed for your community and repurposed. Non-cooperation undermines systems through tactics like boycotts and strikes, whether by workers, students, renters, taxpayers, or debtors. Each of these acts leverages our collective power to say no and disrupt the economic, social, or political stability of those in power. A well-organized and targeted boycott against fast fashion could cripple the profitability of that rapacious industry and refocus folks' consumption to more sustainable alternatives, like thrifting and localized fashion. All along the supply chain, from farmers to garment workers to retail workers, labor strikes are sorely needed to demand better and go further still. Like, we all need to reclaim our time from work to engage in the community and craftsmanship that once defined the textile trade. But to even get folks on board with these kinds of actions, we require some strong messaging and solid education. That's where promotion comes in. By creating and spreading media in a variety of formats that critiques the status quo and shares alternatives, we can help to foster the revolutionary consciousness. We can help to spread new memes. I don't just mean internet memes, though we should definitely bring back Silence Brand. I mean memes in the Dawkins sense, as in, just as our bodies carry genes, our cultures carry memes. We need messaging that calls out the harms of the fashion industry, but also popularizes better practices on the individual and collective levels. A meme to replace the never-ending trend cycle with something far more sustainable and self-expressive. Prefiguration is about building and living out the principles of a future society here and now. That means practicing mutual aid and conflict resolution, or creating spaces of encounter and alternative economies, like the library economy. Imagine libraries of clothing, or maker spaces dedicated to sharing sewing and textile repair skills and tools. Imagine regions spanning clothing exchanges and networks of producers. Transforming our relationship with clothing doesn't have to mean scarcity. It can take the form of a radically creative abundance. This isn't something you just have to imagine. You can help build it. Through these and other acts of social revolution, we develop our powers to enact the changes we seek, which in turn motivates our drives to create even greater changes, and shapes our consciousness of how the world works and what it takes to shape it. So you see, our relationship with clothing touches so many aspects of our society and carries heavy implications for our future. We have a choice. Do we carry on with the meaningless void of consumerism, or do we put in the work, the meaningful work of social revolution, necessary to rebuild the communal focus of fashion? Food, shelter, and clothing are among our most basic needs, yet they also reflect our vast capacity for creativity. I can't wait to see what we come up with when we free ourselves from exploitation. Anarchist Holly Rose Baker explores one possible outcome of this reimagining in Social Fabric, Clothing in a Free Society. I highly recommend giving it a read to stimulate your imagination further. She concludes with this powerful verse. The society is clothed together in the great cloth of interdependence, woven in the 10,000 strands formed by the tensions of material life. It has not come to pass without thought or planning or intention, just as a length of flax left loose will tangle. But together, each giving and using, but none destroying, all are cool in summer, warm in winter, and cozy all year round. Let's draft a new pattern for the future of fashion. All power to all the people. Peace. Thanks for watching. Please like, comment, subscribe, and share with fellow peoples. Thanks to the seedlings, the saplings, and especially the roots for making all of this possible. Including our newest members, Grumpy Old Dragon, Crocodocile, Big Chungus, and Lana Sinapayan. You can join these beautiful humans and support me too on patreon.com/SaintDrew. Check out my other videos for a range of radical topics. Thanks again. Peace.